nose tilted up in defiance. He did not like to be contradicted. Leggett wondered if he might lose his temper. It was not something he had witnessed. On the rare occasions it did occur, it was said to be spectacular. Instead, the Prime Minister said coldly, "The Foreign Secretary has just given us powerful and perhaps even convincing arguments against my proposal, although it does seem to me to be the last real chance we have." He looked around at the faces of his ministers. "But if that is the general view of colleagues..." He left an expectant pause, like an auctioneer hoping for a final bid. Nobody spoke. "If that is the general view," he repeated, and now his voice was harsh in defeat, "I am prepared to leave it at that." He looked at Horace Wilson. "The telegram will not be sent." A collective shifting in seats and adjustment of papers ensued, the voice of peaceable men girding themselves reluctantly for war. The Prime Minister's voice cut through the murmur. He was not done yet. "Before we proceed further, I should inform the Cabinet that I have just received a reply from Herr Hitler. I believe it might be useful if I were to read it to you now." Several of his more sycophantic ministers, Morn, the Lord Chancellor, Shakes Morrison of Agriculture, said, "Yes, and absolutely." The Prime Minister picked up the telegram. "Dear Mr. Chamberlain, I have, in the course of conversations, once more informed Sir Horace Wilson, who brought me your letter of the 26th of September, of my final attitude." It was disconcerting to hear Hitler's demands coming out of Chamberlain's mouth. It made them sound quite reasonable. After all, why should the Czech government object to the immediate occupation of territory which they had already conceded in principle should be transferred to Germany? "This represents no more than a security measure which is intended to guarantee a quick and smooth achievement of the final settlement." When they complained about the loss of their border fortifications, surely the world could see they were only stalling for time. If one were to wait for the entry into force of the final settlement in which Czechoslovakia had completed new fortifications in the territory that remained to her, it would doubtless take months and years. And so it went on. It was almost as if Hitler had been given a seat at the cabinet table to make his case. At the end, the Prime Minister took off his spectacles. "Well, that is obviously very carefully drafted, and will require more time to analyse, but it doesn't leave me entirely without hope." Duff Cooper, the First Lord of the Admiralty, piped up at once. "On the contrary, Prime Minister, he hasn't conceded a single point." He was a raffish figure who always exuded, even in mid-morning, a vague late-night whiff of whisky and cigars and the perfume of other men's wives. His face was flushed. Leggett couldn't tell whether it was anger or if he'd been drinking. "That may be true," said Halifax, "but it's noticeable he hasn't entirely slammed the door either. He does conclude by inviting the Prime Minister to continue his efforts for peace." "Yes, but only in the most lukewarm manner. I leave it to you to decide if it's worth carrying on. He obviously doesn't mean it for a moment. He's just trying to shift the blame for his aggression onto the Czechs." "Well, that is not without significance in itself. It suggests that even Hitler feels he can't entirely ignore world opinion. It may give you something to work on, Prime Minister." "Now see how the holy fox doubles his tracks," thought Leggett. "One minute for war, and the next for peace." Chamberlain said, "Thank you, Foreign Secretary." His tone was chilly. Clearly he had not forgiven him. "You all know my convictions. I intend to go on working for peace until the last possible moment." He glanced over his shoulder at the clock. "Time is drawing on. I need to prepare my statement to Parliament tomorrow. Obviously, I shall have to go further than I did in my broadcast this evening. The House will need to be informed of our warning to Hitler this morning. I suggest we agree collectively on the form of words I should use." He caught Leggett's eye and beckoned him over. In a quiet voice, he said, "Would you be so good as to find me a copy of Hitler's speech from last night? Bring it to me after Cabinet." The only version of Hitler's speech that Leggett could lay his hands on was the one published in that morning's Times. He sat at his desk with his own copy and smoothed the pages flat with his palms. Already it seemed an age since he was sitting reading it in the Ritz, waiting for Pamela to arrive. He suddenly remembered he had promised to call her in the country. He eyed the telephone. It was probably too late now. The children would both be in bed, and doubtless Pamela would have drunk one cocktail too many and had a row with her parents. The awfulness of the day overwhelmed him. The abandoned lunch, the workmen in Green Park, the barrage balloons rising over the Thames, the gas masks for his children, the car pulling away from the curb in North Street. And tomorrow would be worse. Tomorrow, the Germans would mobilize, and he would be questioned by the Secret Intelligence Service. He would not be able to deflect them as easily as he had Cadogan. They would have his file. He heard voices. It sounded as though the cabinet meeting was over. He stood and crossed over to the door. The ministers were emerging into the corridor. Normally, after cabinet, there was some laughter, a little backslapping, even an occasional argument. There was none of that tonight. Apart from a couple of hushed conversations, most of the politicians put their heads down and hurried out of Number 10 alone. He watched the tall, solitary figure of Halifax put on his bowler hat and collect his umbrella from the stand. Through the open door came the now familiar cold white flickering and shouted questions. Leggett waited until he judged the Prime Minister must be alone, then entered the cabinet room. It was deserted. The litter and the overwhelming smell of stale tobacco smoke reminded him of a railway station waiting room. To his right, the door to Cleverley's office was half open. He could hear the Secretary to the Cabinet and the Principal Private Secretary conferring. To his left, the door to Horace Wilson's room was closed. He knocked and heard Wilson call out for him to come in. Wilson was at a side table, squirting soda from a siphon into two tumblers of what looked like brandy. The Prime Minister was sprawled back in an armchair, legs outstretched, arms dangling over the sides. His eyes were closed. He opened them as Leggett approached. "I'm afraid I could only find the speech in the Times, Prime Minister."
"That's all right. That's where I read it. Gosh!"
With a groan of exhaustion, he hauled himself from the depths of the armchair. His legs moved stiffly. He took the newspaper, placed it open at the speech on Wilson's desk, extracted his spectacles from his breast pocket, and began looking up and down the columns of newsprint. His mouth hung open slightly. Wilson came over from the side table and politely showed Leggett the tumbler. Leggett shook his head. "No, thank you, Sir Horace." Wilson placed it next to the Prime Minister. He looked at Leggett and raised his eyebrows slightly. There was something almost shocking in the complicity of it, the suggestion that they were both having to humour the old man. The Prime Minister said,
"This is it. We have never found a single great power in Europe with a man at its head who has as much understanding for the distress of our people as my great friend Benito Mussolini. We shall never forget what he has done in this time or the attitude of the Italian people. If similar distress should ever befall Italy, I shall go to the German people and ask them to do for the Italians what the Italians have done for us."
He pushed the paper across the desk for Wilson to look at. He picked up the tumbler and took a sip.
"You see what I mean?"
"I do."
"Hitler plainly isn't going to listen to me, but he might well listen to Musso."
He sat at the desk, took a sheet of Number 10 notepaper, and dipped a pen in the inkwell. He paused to take another drink, gazed ahead in thought, then started to write. After a while, he said to Leggett, without looking up,
"I want you to take this to the Foreign Office cipher room right away and have them telegraph it immediately to Lord Perth at the embassy in Rome."
"Yes, Prime Minister."
Wilson said, "If you're writing to the ambassador, don't you think you ought to tell the Foreign Office?"
"Damn the Foreign Office." The Prime Minister blotted the wet ink. He turned and smiled up at Leggett. "Please forget you heard that last remark." He held out the letter.
"And when you've done that, we'll get to work on my speech to Parliament."
A minute later, Leggett was hurrying back across Downing Street towards the Foreign Office. The road was clear. The crowds had gone. Thick cloud over London obscured the stars and moon. An hour remained until midnight. Chapter 6. The lights were still switched on in Potsdamer Platz, looming war or no. The dome of the Haus Vaterland, with its UFA cinema and its giant café, was lit by traceries of 4,000 electric bulbs. Opposite it, An illuminated billboard showed a movie star with glistening jet black hair, his face at least 10 meters high, smoking a Macedon cigarette. Perfect. Hartmann waited for a tram to pass, then strolled across the street to the Wannsee Bahnhof. 5 minutes later, he was aboard one of the suburban electric trains, rattling southwest into the night. He could not entirely throw off the sensation that he was being followed, even though his carriage, he had chosen to ride in the last one, was empty apart from a pair of drunks and an SA man reading the Volkischer Beobachter. The drunks got off at Schöneberg, bowing to him elaborately as they left, and then it was only him and the stormtrooper. The city lights dwindled. Great areas of darkness spread around him like mysterious black lakes. He guessed they must be parks. From time to time, the train jolted and threw out blue flashes of electric sparks. They stopped at little stations, Friedenau and Feuerbachstrasse, the automatic doors opening onto deserted platforms. Finally, as they came into Steglitz, the SA man folded his paper and got to his feet. He brushed past Hartmann on his way to the door. He smelled of sweat and beer and leather. He hooked his thumbs into his belt and turned to address Hartmann. His plump, brown-clad body swayed with the train. He reminded Hartmann of a fat chrysalis about to burst.
Those fellows were disgusting.
Oh, I don't know. They seemed harmless enough.
No. Should have been locked up.
The doors opened, and he stumbled out onto the platform. As the train pulled away, Hartmann looked back and saw him bent over, hands on his knees, vomiting. Out here, the trees grew close to the track. The trunks of silver birches flashed past, luminous in the dark. One might imagine oneself to be in a forest. He rested his cheek against the cool glass of the window and thought of home and boyhood and camping in the summer, of singing and campfires, of the Wandervogel and the Nibelungbund, of the noble elite and the salvation of the nation. He felt a sudden sense of exhilaration. A few more passengers got off at Botanischer Garten, and at last he felt sure he was alone. At the next stop, Lichterfelde West, he was the only person to alight onto the platform, until the very last moment when the doors had already started to close, and a man in the carriage in front just managed to squeeze through the gap. He glanced briefly over his shoulder as the train pulled away, and Hartmann had an impression of a blunt-jawed, brutal face. The Liebstandarte SS Adolf Hitler, the Führer's bodyguard, had their barracks in Lichterfelde. Perhaps he was an officer off duty. The man bent to tie his shoelace, and Hartmann walked quickly past him, along the platform, up the flight of steps, through the deserted station with its closed ticket office, and out into the street. He had memorized the route before he left the office. Right, right, fourth left, but instinct warned him to wait. He crossed the cobbled square in front of the station and stood in the doorway of the butcher's shop opposite. The station was eccentric. It had been built in the last century to resemble an Italianate villa. He felt as if he was a spy in a foreign country. After half a minute, his fellow passenger emerged, hesitated, and looked around as if searching for Hartmann, then turned right and disappeared. Hartmann gave it another 5 minutes before he set off. It was a pleasant, leafy, bourgeois suburb, hardly a place in which to plot treason. Most of the inhabitants were already asleep, their shutters closed. A couple of dogs barked as he passed. He wondered why Oster wanted them to meet out here. He walked down Königsberger Straße and into Goethestrasse. Number 9 was a plain, double-fronted house, the sort of villa a bank manager might choose to live in, or a headmaster. The lights in the front windows were off, and suddenly it occurred to Hartmann that he might be walking into a trap. Kort was a Nazi, after all. He had worked with Ribbentrop for years. But then Hartmann was a party member himself. If one wanted to rise to a position of any influence, one had to be. He banished his suspicion, opened the little wooden gate, marched up the path to the front door, and rang the bell. A well-educated voice said, "Identify yourself." "Hartmann, Foreign Ministry." The door was unlocked. An elderly, bald-headed man of about 60 stood on the threshold. Large, round, melancholy blue eyes were set deep into his skull. A small dueling scar ran horizontally just below the left corner of his mouth. It was a fine, intelligent face. In his grey suit and blue tie, he might have been a professor. "Beck," he said, and stuck out his hand. He pulled Hartman into the house with a firm grip, then shut the door and locked it. "My God," thought Hartman. "It's Ludwig Beck, General Beck, the chief of the general's staff." "This way, please." Beck led him down a passage towards a room at the back of the house, where half a dozen men were seated. "I presume you know most of these gentlemen?"
"Indeed." Hartman nodded a general greeting. How much the strain had aged them over just the last few months. There was the clerkish court, whose elder brother Theo was the chargé d'affaires at the embassy in London, another member of the opposition who so hated Ribbentrop he had decided he was willing to risk his neck to stop him, and Colonel Oster, the deputy head of military intelligence, a cavalryman of charm, who was their leader, in so far as so vociferous a group could tolerate such a thing, and Hans Bernd Gisevius, and Count von Schulenburg of the Interior Ministry, and Hans von der Hagny of the Justice Ministry. The sixth man he didn't know, but he recognized him. It was the S-Bahn passenger he had seen earlier tying his shoelaces at the railway station. Oster noticed his look of surprise. "This is Captain Friedrich Heinz. I don't expect you know him. He's on my staff at the Abwehr. He is our man of action," he added with a smile. Hartman didn't doubt it. The Abwehr man had the face of a boxer who had been in too many fights. "We've met," said Hartman, after a fashion. He sat down on the sofa. The room was oppressively hot and cramped. A pair of heavy velvet curtains was drawn across the window. The bookshelves were full of literature, French as well as German, and volumes of philosophy. On the table was a jug of water and some small glasses. Oster said, "I'm grateful to General Beck for agreeing to see us tonight. The General would like to say something, I believe." Beck had seated himself on a hard wooden chair that placed him slightly higher than the rest of them. "Only Colonel Oster and Herr Gisevius are aware of what I'm about to tell you." His voice was dry, clipped, precise. "A little under 6 weeks ago, I resigned as Chief of the General Staff in protest at the plan to go to war with Czechoslovakia. You won't have heard of my action because I promised the Führer I wouldn't make it public. I regret agreeing to his request, but there it is, I gave my word. However, I am still in touch with my former colleagues in the High Command, and I can tell you that there is strong opposition to what is happening. So strong that I believe that if Hitler issues the order for mobilization tomorrow, there is a good chance the army will disobey it and move against the regime instead." There was a silence. Hartman could feel his pulse accelerating. Oster said, "Obviously this changes everything. We now have to be prepared to act decisively tomorrow. We will never get a better chance." Kort said skeptically, "And how is this coup to happen?" "With one stroke. The arrest of Hitler." "The army will do this?" "No. We will need to do it."
"But surely only the army has the strength to accomplish such a task."
Beck said, "The Wehrmacht's difficulty is that we have sworn an oath of loyalty to the Führer. However, if there were to be some sort of disturbance in the Chancellery, the army could certainly move in to maintain order. That would not be incompatible with our oath. It's merely that the first move against Hitler could not be ours. It would have to come from others."
Oster said, "I have been analysing this for weeks. It really wouldn't take many men to arrest Hitler, provided we had the advantage of surprise, along with an undertaking that the army would then protect us from any rescue attempt by the SS. Captain Heinz and I estimate we would need an initial force of about 50 men."
"And where are we to find these 50 men?" asked Kort.
"We already have them," said Heinz. "Experienced fighters, prepared to move tomorrow."
"Good God!"
Kort stared at him as if he were crazy.
"Who are they? Where are they? How are they armed?"
"The Abwehr will issue them with weapons," said Oster. "We are also providing them with safe houses close to Wilhelmstrasse, where they can wait until they receive the signal to move."
Heinz said, "They will be in position at dawn tomorrow. Each one of these men is a reliable comrade, known personally to me. Remember, I fought with Kapp in 1920, then with the Stahlhelm. It's true, if anyone can pull it off, Heinz can.
Hartmann knew Schulenburg only vaguely, a socialist aristocrat who had joined the party before it came to power and who had since become disillusioned. Nowadays he was stuck in some low-level police job in the Interior Ministry. Schulenburg said to Beck, "And you really think, General, that the army will turn on the Führer, after all he's done for them, and for Germany?"
"I agree that much of what he's achieved in the foreign sphere has been remarkable. The return of the Rhineland, the incorporation of Austria. But the point is, they were bloodless victories, and the return of the Sudetenland could be bloodless too. Unfortunately, he isn't interested in achieving his aims peacefully anymore. The truth about Hitler, I came to realize over the summer, is that he actually wants war with Czechoslovakia. He is under the delusion that he is some kind of military genius, even though he never rose higher than corporal. You fail to understand the man unless you understand that. And on one thing the army has agreed, war with France and Britain this year would be a disaster for Germany."
Hartmann took his opportunity to speak. "Actually, I can show you the latest proof that Hitler wants war." He reached into his inside pocket and pulled out the text of Hitler's letter to Chamberlain. "This is the Führer's response to the British, sent to London earlier tonight." He handed the telegram to Oster, then sat back and lit a cigarette and watched as the letter was passed around.
Kott said, "How did you get hold of this?"
"I had to take it from the Reich Chancellery to the British Embassy. I made a copy."
"That was quick work."
"Well, this settles it, gentlemen," said Oster when he had finished reading. "There's not a hint of compromise anywhere in it."
Beck said, "It's tantamount to a declaration of war."
Oster said, "We need to get it into the hands of the Commander-in-Chief first thing tomorrow morning. If this doesn't convince him that Hitler isn't bluffing, nothing will. Is it all right for us to keep it, Hartmann, or does it need to go back to the Foreign Ministry?"
Hartmann, "No, you can show that to the army."
The Hanyi, a skinny, bespectacled figure, who even in his mid-thirties still looked like a law student, raised his hand.
"I have a question for Captain Heinz. Assuming we succeed in arresting Hitler tomorrow, what will we do with him?"
"Kill him," said Heinz.
"No, no, no, I don't agree with that."
"Why not? Do you imagine he'd hesitate for a second to do the same to us?"
"Of course not. But I don't want to stoop to his level of brutality. Besides, killing him would turn him into the greatest martyr in German history. The country would live in his shadow for generations."
"Naturally, we won't announce we killed him. We can simply say he died in the fighting."
"That won't fool anyone. The truth will come out. It always does."
He appealed to the room. "Gisevius, help me here."
"I don't know what I think."
Gisevius was a baby-faced lawyer who had started his career in the Gestapo until he realized the sort of people he was working with.
"I suppose the best course would be to put him on trial. We have a file of evidence against him, a meter thick."
Beck said, "I agree absolutely.
I couldn't be a party to any extrajudicial killing. The fellow should be taken somewhere secure and subjected to a thorough psychiatric examination. Then he can either be locked away in an asylum or made to account for his crimes."
Heinz muttered,
"Psychiatric examination?"
Oster said, "Cord, what's your opinion?"
"The problem with the trial is that it will give him a platform. He would be brilliant in a courtroom. Remember what happened after the beer hall putsch?"
"That's true. Hartmann, your view?"
"If you want my advice, we should kill the whole filthy lot of them. Himmler, Goebbels, Goering, the entire criminal gang."
The violence in his voice surprised him. His fists were clenched. He stopped, conscious of Oster staring at him.
"My dear Hartmann, usually so detached and ironical. Who knew you carried such hate?"
Heinz was looking at him with interest for the first time.
"You say you were in the Chancellery this evening?"
"That's right."
"Could you make sure you were there tomorrow morning?"
"Perhaps."
Hartmann glanced over at Kort.
"Erich, what do you think?"
"I expect we could find some pretext. Why?"
"We need someone on the inside to make sure the doors stay open."
"All right." Hartmann nodded.
I'll try.
Good.
The Hanyi said,
But what shall we do with Hitler, gentlemen? What is our decision?
The conspirators looked from one to another. Eventually, Oster said,
This is like arguing about what form of government we should have after the Third Reich. Will it be a monarchy or a democratic republic or some combination of the two? The fact is, as the proverb says, before you can cook your rabbit, you first have to catch it. Our absolute priority has to be stopping this madman from issuing the order for mobilization tomorrow afternoon. All else must be secondary to that objective. If he surrenders himself into our custody, all well and good, and we'll take him alive. If it looks as though he might get away, I don't think we have any choice except to shoot him. Can we agree on that?
Hartmann was the first to nod. I second that. One by one, the others followed suit, including, eventually, Bahanyi. And, finally, and most obviously reluctantly, Beck.
Good, said Oster with a sigh of relief. That at least is settled. Tomorrow we strike.
They left the house at intervals to avoid attracting attention. Hartmann was the first to go. A brief handshake with each of the others, an exchange of glances, a muttered good luck from Oster. That was all. The contrast between the violence they were contemplating and the sleeping suburban street was so incongruous that Hartmann had barely gone 50 paces before the entire encounter began to seem like an hallucination. He had to repeat the astonishing truth to himself. By this time tomorrow, Hitler could be dead. It was both impossible and yet entirely feasible. The hurling of a bomb, the pulling of a trigger, the slashing of a knife across the tyrant's throat, wasn't this how history was so often made? For a moment he imagined himself as some noble young senator walking back from Brutus's house on the eve of the Ides of March, down from the Palatine to the Forum Romanum under the same cloudy European sky. He saw a signpost pointing to the river. On impulse he followed it. He was too restless to think of returning to his apartment. In the middle of the bridge he stopped to light a cigarette. There was no traffic. Beneath him the Spree was greyly luminescent, disappearing into the distance between dark masses of trees towards the centre of Berlin. He set off along the footpath that ran beside it. He couldn't see the water, but he could sense its rustling movement, could hear its soft splashes as it encountered rocks and undergrowth. He must have walked for a couple of kilometres, his head full of images of violence and martyrdom, until eventually streetlights appeared ahead. The path ended in a small park with a children's play area, slide, swings, a seesaw, a sandpit. The prosaic sight depressed him. It brought him back to earth. Who was he? Who indeed were Oster, Heinz, Dohanyi, Schulenburg, Kott and Beck? A handful against millions. They must be mad to think they could bring it off. On the far side of the park was a main road where the last bus from Steglitz was waiting to depart for the city. He climbed the twisting staircase to the upper deck. A young couple occupied the front seat, his arm around her shoulders, her head resting against his cheek. He sat at the back and watched them. In the cold, stale air of the bus, he could smell the girl's perfume. The engine whined. The bus swayed. When she started to kiss her boyfriend, he looked away. 10 minutes later, as they came into Schöneberg, he went back down the steps and stood on the platform until he saw a street he recognized. The bus slowed slightly, and he jumped off it sideways, his legs absorbing the impact in half a dozen long strides until he was able to bring himself to a halt. Her apartment block was above an automobile showroom. Behind the plate glass, in the harsh neon light, swastika banners hung from the ceiling between glittering Opels and Mercedes. The entrance was unlocked. He climbed 3 floors, past the heavy closed doors of the other apartments. The landing smelled of dried flowers. There must be money somewhere for her to afford all this. Almost as soon as he rang the bell, she let him in. He wondered if she had been waiting for him.
Frau Winter. Herr Hartmann.
She locked the door behind him. She was wearing a kimono, the belt untied, her toenails painted the same brilliant scarlet as the silk. Her black hair, unpinned now that she was away from the office, fell all the way to the small of her back. The skin of her feet, of her stomach, and between her breasts was alabaster white. As he followed her into the bedroom, he could hear a radio in the sitting room, tuned illegally to a foreign station playing jazz. She slipped off her robe and left it pooled on the carpet, then lay on the bed and watched him undress. When he was naked, he moved to switch off the light. No, leave it. She guided him into her at once. She never wanted them to take their time. It was one of the things he liked about her. Afterwards, as she always did, she went into the kitchen to fetch them a drink, leaving him, as usual, to stare at the photograph on the nightstand of her dead husband. She never removed it or laid it flat. Late 20s, infantry captain, handsome in his uniform in the photographer's studio, his gloved hands resting on the hilt of his sword. Hartman guessed he must be about the same age as him. Was that what this was about? Did she like to imagine it was the ghost of Captain Winter who was fucking her? She came back into the bedroom naked, two cigarettes between her lips, a glass of whiskey in either hand, a large envelope under her arm. She gave him his drink and cigarette, then dropped the envelope onto his chest. He looked down his nose at it without moving. "What's this?"
"See for yourself."
The bed creaked as she climbed back onto it. She hugged her knees and watched as he opened it. He pulled out the pages and started to read.
"My God," he said abruptly. "You want the English to fight? Show them that."
Day 2. Chapter 1. It took Leggett a few moments to work out where he was. His narrow mattress was hard. The room was not much larger than the metal bed frame, Regency-striped wallpaper, a ceiling that sloped steeply at an angle of nearly 45 degrees. No window. Instead, a skylight directly above his head, through which he found himself squinting at a low grey cloud. Seagulls whirled across it, like litter in the wind. It reminded him of a seaside boarding house. He groped around the bedside table and opened his pocket watch. 9:15. The Prime Minister had kept him up, fetching documents for his speech, until nearly 3. Afterwards he had lain awake for hours. He must have fallen asleep just before dawn. He felt as if someone had rubbed grit in his eyes. He threw off the sheet and blanket and swung his feet to the floor. He was wearing a pair of duck-egg blue pyjamas from Gives and Hawks that Pamela had given him for his birthday. Over these he pulled a plaid dressing gown. Sponge bag in hand, he opened the door and peered into the corridor. There were 3 bedrooms crammed into the attic of number 10 for staff who had to be on call throughout the night. As far as he could tell, he was the only occupant. The pale green Ministry of Works linoleum was clammy underfoot. It flowed along the passage and into the bathroom. He pulled the light cord. Again, no window. He had to run the tap for more than a minute before the water turned lukewarm. While he waited, he placed a hand on either side of the basin and leaned towards the mirror. Increasingly these days, the face he shaved was his father's. A face from a sepia photograph. Manly, resolute, oddly innocent. All that was lacking was the large dark moustache. He lathered his face with soap. Back in his room, he put on a clean shirt and threaded his cufflinks. He knotted his purple and dark blue striped Balliol tie. Behold, the third secretary. It was 5 years to the day since he had looked in the back pages of the Times and discovered the list of successful candidates in the 1933 Diplomatic Service entrance examinations. The names were printed in order of marks achieved. Leggett, Riley, Cresswell, Shuckburgh, Gorbooth, Gray, Malcolm, Hogg. He had read it several times before it sank in. He had come top. A few lines of newsprint had turned him from an Oxford graduate with a first-class degree in mods and greats into a man of the world, an official high flyer. He would be an ambassador, certainly, possibly even permanent under-secretary. Everybody said so. 2 days later, still in a state of euphoria, he had proposed to Pamela, and, to his amazement, she had accepted.
If anything, her fantasies had outstripped his own. She would be Lady Leggett. She would preside elegantly and effortlessly over receptions at the Paris Embassy in the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré. They had both behaved like children. It had been madness. And now the world had grown old and ugly around them. By the time he was fully dressed, it was 9 o'clock. There were 6 hours left until Hitler's ultimatum expired. He went in search of breakfast. The narrow stairs led down to a landing outside the Prime Minister's flat, and from there to the anteroom next to Chamberlain's study. His intention was to slip out to the Lion's Corner House near Trafalgar Square. He could be there and back in 30 minutes, but before he could reach the main staircase, he heard a door open behind him, and a woman's voice called out, "Mr. Leggett, good morning." He stopped and turned to face her. "Good morning, Mrs. Chamberlain." Her costume was funereal, charcoal grey and black, with a necklace of large beads of jet. "Did you manage to get some sleep?" "Yes, thank you." "Come and have some breakfast." "I was just about to go out."
"Don't be silly. We always give the duty secretary breakfast."
She peered at him myopically.
"It's Hugh, isn't it?"
"That's right. But really..."
"Nonsense. There's such a crowd gathering outside already. It will be much easier for you to eat here."
She took his arm and gently tugged him after her. They passed through the state drawing rooms, watched by various Whig and Tory statesmen, looking down their noses at them from heavy gilt frames. To his surprise, she continued to hold on to him. They might have been fellow guests at a country house weekend, going in to dinner together.
"I'm so grateful for all that you young men do for my husband."
Her tone was confiding.
"You have no idea how much you lighten his burden. And don't say you're just doing your job. I know the personal cost of public service."
She opened the door to the dining room. It was not the grand official one, but the more intimate wood-panelled room with a table for 12. At the far end, reading the Times, was the Prime Minister. He looked up at his wife and smiled.
"Good morning, my dear."
He nodded at Leggett.
"Good morning."
He resumed reading. Mrs. Chamberlain gestured to a side table where half a dozen dishes with silver covers were warming on a hot plate.
"Do please help yourself. Coffee?"
"Thank you." She handed him a cup and went and sat next to the Prime Minister. Leggett lifted the nearest cover. The greasy, sweet smell of the bacon reminded him how hungry he was. He went along the table, filling his plate. Scrambled eggs, mushrooms, sausages, black pudding. When he sat down, Mrs. Chamberlain smiled at the size of his breakfast.
"Are you married, Hugh?"
"Yes, Mrs. Chamberlain."
"Any children?"
"A boy and a girl."
"Exactly the same as us. How old?"
"They're 3 and 2.
"Oh, how wonderful.
Ours are much older. Dorothy is 27. She was recently married. Frank is 24.
"Do you like this coffee?"
Leggett took a sip. It was disgusting.
"It's very good, thank you.
I make it with chicory." The Prime Minister rustled his paper slightly and grunted. Mrs. Chamberlain fell silent and poured herself some tea. Leggett resumed eating. For several minutes there was silence.
"Ah, now this is interesting."
The Prime Minister suddenly lifted his paper and folded it to the page she had been reading.
"Could you make a note of this?"
Leggett quickly put down his knife and fork and took out his notebook.
"I shall need to write a letter to..."
He brought the small print up close to his eyes.
"A Mr. G. J. Scholey of 38 Dysart Avenue, Kingston-upon-Thames."
"Yes, Prime Minister." Leggett was bewildered.
"He has a letter to the editor printed. In the spring of this year, I was observing a blackbird with a nest of eggs in a steep bank. Upon my approach each day, the sitting bird would allow me to observe her at a few feet distant. And then one morning her familiar figure was missing. On peering over the bank, I found her 4 young chicks cold and lifeless in the nest. A thin trail of blackish breast feathers led me down the bank to a small bush, under which I discovered the mangled remains of my old blackbird. And intermingled in that trail of blackbird's feathers were a few others, which could only have come from the breast and flanks of a little owl."
The Prime Minister tapped the paper with his finger.
"I have observed exactly the same behaviour by the little owls at Chequers."
Mrs. Chamberlain said,
"Oh, really, Neville, as if Hugh hasn't got enough to do."
Leggett said. Actually, I believe it was my grandfather on my mother's side who helped introduce the little owl to the British Isles.
Did he really?
For the first time, the Prime Minister looked at him with genuine interest. Yes, he brought several pairs back with him from India.
What year would this have been?
I should think about 1880.
So, in barely more than 50 years, this little bird has spread all over southern England. That is something to celebrate.
Not if you're a blackbird, apparently, said Mrs. Chamberlain.
Do you have time for a walk, Neville?
She looked across the table at Leggett. We always take a walk together after breakfast. The Prime Minister put down his paper.
Yes, I need some air, but not the park, I'm afraid. Not today. There are too many people. It will have to be the garden.
Why don't you come with us, Hugh? He followed the Chamberlains as they descended the grand staircase arm in arm. When they reached the private secretary's corridor, the Prime Minister turned round to Leggett.
Would you mind just checking whether there's been a reply from Rome to my telegram last night?
Of course, Prime Minister. They continued on to the cabinet room, while Leggett ducked into his office. Miss Watson was behind her wall of files.
Has the Foreign Office messenger been over yet?
Not that I've seen.
He checked with Sires, who said,
They don't normally show up till 11. How was last night?
This morning, you mean?
Christ, how are you feeling?
Bloody awful.
And the PM?
Fresh as a daisy.
Irritating, isn't it? I don't know how he does it.
Cleverly was in his office dictating a letter to his secretary. Leggett put his head round the door.
Excuse me, sir. Has a telegram come in from the Rome Embassy this morning? The Prime Minister wants to know.
I haven't seen anything.
Why, what's he expecting?
He wrote to Lord Perth late last night.
About what?
Instructing him to ask Mussolini to intervene with Hitler. Cleverly looked alarmed.
But that wasn't authorised at Cabinet. Does the Foreign Secretary know?
I'm not sure.
Not sure? It's your job to be sure.
He reached for the telephone. Leggett took advantage of his distraction to escape. Inside the cabinet room, one of the doors to the terrace was open. The Chamberlains had already descended the steps and were strolling across the lawn. Leggett hurried after them.
No reply from Rome yet, Prime Minister.
You are sure it was sent?
Definitely. I stood in the cipher room and watched it go.
Well, then, we shall just have to be patient.
The Chamberlains resumed their walk. Leggett felt awkward. He was conscious of Cleverly standing at his office window, talking on the telephone, watching him. Nevertheless, he fell in behind them. The weather was still mild and gloomy, the big trees turning brown. Drifts of fallen leaves lay across the damp grass and the flower beds. From beyond the high wall came the sound of traffic. The Prime Minister stopped beside a bird table. From his pocket he pulled a piece of toast he had taken from the rack at breakfast. He broke it into pieces and laid them out carefully, then stepped back and folded his arms. He was brooding.
"What a day this promises to be," he said quietly.
"You know, I would gladly stand up against that wall and be shot, if only I could prevent war."
"Neville, really, please don't say such things."
Mrs. Chamberlain looked as if she were about to burst into tears. The Prime Minister said to Leggett, "You were too young to fight in the last war, and I was too old. In some ways, that made it worse." He glanced up at the sky. "It was an absolute agony to me to see such suffering and to be so powerless. 750,000 men killed from this country alone. Just imagine it. And it wasn't just they who suffered, but their parents and their wives and children, their families, their friends. And afterwards, whenever I saw a war memorial or visited one of those vast cemeteries in France where so many dear friends are buried, I always vowed that if ever I was in a position to prevent such a catastrophe from happening again, I would do anything, sacrifice anything, to maintain peace. You can understand that?"
"Of course.
This is sacred to me."
"I understand.
And it all happened only 20 years ago."
He fixed Leggett with a gaze almost fanatical in its intensity.
"It's not simply that this country is militarily and psychologically unprepared for war. That can be remedied. We are remedying it.
It's rather that I truly fear for the spiritual health of our people, if they don't see their leaders doing absolutely everything they can to prevent a second great conflict. Because of one thing, I can assure you, if it comes, the next war will be infinitely worse than the last, and they will require great fortitude to survive it. Suddenly, he turned on his heel and started marching back across the lawn to number 10. Mrs. Chamberlain stared helplessly at Leggett for a moment, then went after him.
Neville!
The energy of the old man was more than merely remarkable, thought Leggett. It was disconcerting. The Prime Minister trotted up the dozen steps to the terrace and disappeared into the cabinet room. His wife was not far behind. Leggett followed them at a distance. On the terrace he stopped. Through the open door he could see the Chamberlains embracing. The Prime Minister was stroking her back in reassurance. After a while he stepped away slightly. He held her by the shoulders and stared at her intently. Leggett couldn't see her face.
"Go on, Annie,"
he said gently. He smiled at her, brushed something from her cheek.
"We'll be all right."
She nodded and left without turning round. The Prime Minister beckoned Leggett into the room. He pulled a chair out from the cabinet table. "Sit down," he ordered. Leggett sat. Chamberlain stayed on his feet. He patted his inside pockets, pulled out a cigar case, tipped out a cigar and snipped off the end with his thumb. He struck a match and lit the cigar, sucking at it until it was well alight. With a vigorous shake of his hand, he extinguished the match and threw it into the ashtray. "Take this down." Leggett reached for a sheet of headed notepaper, pen and ink. "To Reich Chancellor Adolf Hitler." His nib scratched across the paper. "After reading your letter, I feel certain that you can get all essentials without war and without delay." Leggett waited. The Prime Minister paced up and down behind him. "I'm ready to come to Berlin myself at once to discuss arrangements for transfer with you and the representatives of the Czech government." He paused until he saw Leggett had caught up. "Together with representatives of France and Italy, if you desire. I feel convinced that we could reach agreement in a week." At the end of the room, the door opened, and Horace Wilson slipped in. He nodded to the Prime Minister and took a seat in the far corner of the table. Chamberlain resumed. "I cannot believe that you will take the responsibility of starting a world war which may end civilization for the sake of a few days' delay in settling this long-standing problem." He stopped. Leggett glanced round at him.
"Is that it, Prime Minister?"
"That's it. Sign it with my name, and have it sent care of Sir Neville Henderson in Berlin."
He turned to Wilson.
"All right?"
"Excellent."
Leggett began to stand.
Chamberlain said, "Wait, there's another one. This one to Signor Mussolini."
He took a few more puffs on his cigar.
"I have today addressed a last appeal to Herr Hitler to abstain from force to settle this Sudeten problem, which I feel sure can be settled by a short discussion and will give him the essential territory, population, and protection for both Sudetens and Czechs during transfer. I have offered myself to go at once to Berlin to discuss arrangements with German and Czech representatives, and, if the Chancellor desires, representatives also of Italy and France."
Across the table, Leggett could see Wilson nodding slowly. The Prime Minister continued.
"I trust Your Excellency will inform the German Chancellor that you're willing to be represented and urge him to agree to my proposal, which will keep all our peoples out of war. I have already guaranteed that Czech promises shall be carried out, and feel confident full agreement could be reached in a week."
Wilson said,
"Are you going to inform the Cabinet?"
"No."
"Is that constitutional?"
"I don't know. And frankly, at this stage, what does it matter? Either this will work, and everyone will be too relieved afterwards to quibble, or it won't, and they will be too busy trying on gas masks to care."
He said to Leggett, "Will you take those over to the Foreign Office and make sure they're dispatched at once?"
"Of course, Prime Minister."
He gathered the papers together.
"At any rate," Chamberlain resumed to Wilson, "my conscience will be clear.
The world will see I have done everything humanely possible to avoid war. The responsibility from now on rests solely with Hitler. Leggett quietly closed the door. Chapter 2. Hartmann sat at his desk and pretended to work. In the open file in front of him was a copy of the Führer's latest telegram to President Roosevelt, dispatched the previous evening. It justified invasion on the grounds that 214,000 Sudeten Germans had so far been forced to flee their homes to escape the outrageous violence and bloody terror inflicted on them by the Czechs. Countless dead, thousands of injured, tens of thousands of detainees and prisoners, desolate villages. How much of this was true? Some of it? None of it? Hartmann had no idea. Truth was like any other material necessary for the making of war. It had to be beaten and bent and cut into the required shape. Nowhere in the telegram was any hint of compromise. For the 100th time he checked his watch. It was 11:03. Over by the windows, von Nostitz and von Ransau were also at their desks. They were staring down into the street as if waiting for something to happen. Neither had uttered more than a dozen words all morning. Nostitz, who worked in the protocol department, was a party member. Ransau, who had been due to go to the London embassy as second secretary until the Sudeten crisis blew up, was not. They weren't such bad fellows, Hartmann thought. He had mixed with such types all his life. Patriotic, conservative, clannish. For them, Hitler was like some crude gamekeeper who had mysteriously contrived to take over the running of their family estates. Once installed, he had proved an unexpected success, and they had consented to tolerate his occasional bad manners and lapses into violence in return for a quiet life. Now they had discovered they couldn't get rid of him, and they looked as if they were starting to regret it. Hartmann briefly considered confiding in them, but decided it was too risky. The shrilling of his telephone made all three men jump. He picked up the receiver. "Hartmann? Paul, it's Kort. Come to my office immediately." The line went dead. Hartmann hung up. Ransau couldn't keep the anxiety out of his voice. "Is something going on?" "I don't know. I'm wanted over the road." Hartmann closed the Roosevelt file. Beneath it was the envelope he had been given by Frau Winter. He ought to have hidden it somewhere when he went back to his apartment to change, but he couldn't think of any place secure enough. Now he slipped it into an empty folder, unlocked the bottom left-hand drawer of his desk, and buried it in a pile of documents. He locked the drawer and stood. It struck him that if things went wrong, he might never see his colleagues again. He felt an unexpected rush of affection. Not such bad fellows. He said, "If I hear anything more, I'll let you know." He collected his hat and hurried out of the door before his face could betray him, or they could ask him more questions. Although he had been made foreign minister in February, Ribbentrop still preferred to operate out of his old headquarters on the opposite side of Wilhelmstrasse in the massive Prussian Ministry of State building. His staff shared the same floor as the deputy Führer, Rudolf Hess, and Hartmann was obliged to make his way past half a dozen brown-uniformed Nazi Party officials, huddled in conversation, before he reached Kort's office. Kort himself opened the door, beckoned him inside, and locked it after him. Normally he had a secretary, but she wasn't there. He must have sent her away. "Oster just came to see me. He says it's happening." The Rhinelander's eyes were blinking rapidly behind his thick glasses. He opened his desk drawer and took out a pair of handguns. "He gave me these." He laid them on the desk carefully. Hartmann took one. It was the latest Walter, small, only about 15 centimeters long, easy to conceal. He weighed it in his hand, clicked the safety catch off and on. "Loaded?" Cobb nodded. Suddenly he started giggling like a schoolboy. "I can't believe this is happening. I've never fired a gun in my life. Have you?" "I've hunted since I was a boy." Hartmann took aim at the filing cabinet. His finger tightened around the trigger.
Rifles, mostly. Shotguns.
Isn't it the same thing?
Not exactly, but the principle is the same.
So what's going on?
Oster gave your copy of Hitler's reply to Chamberlain to General Halder in Army Headquarters this morning.
Who's Halder?
Beck's successor as Chief of the General Staff. Halder was appalled, according to Oster. He's definitely with us. Even more opposed to Hitler than Beck. He'll order the army to move?
Cord shook his head.
He hasn't the authority. He's in charge of planning, not operations. He's going to talk to Brauchitsch, the commander-in-chief. Brauchitsch has the power.
Would you mind putting that thing down? You're making me nervous.
Hartmann lowered the gun. And Brauchitsch is sympathetic?
Apparently.
So what happens now? You're to go over to the Chancellery now, exactly as we agreed last night.
On what pretext?
The British Embassy just rang. It seems Chamberlain has written another letter to Hitler, God knows what it says, and Henderson wants an appointment to deliver it by hand to the Führer as soon as possible. The request has been cleared by Ribbentrop, and he's with the Führer now. I thought you could go over and inform him.
Hartmann considered this. It sounded plausible.
All right. He tried concealing the gun in various pockets. It fitted best inside his double-breasted jacket, on the left, next to his heart. He could draw it with his right hand. When he had fastened the buttons, it was hard to tell it was there. Codd was watching him with something like horror. He said, "Telephone me the moment you have Ribbentrop's response. I'll come over and join you. For God's sake, remember, your job is simply to keep the doors open. Don't get involved in any shooting. That's for Heinz and his men."
"I understand."
Hartmann tugged his jacket straight. "Well, then, I'd better go." Cott unlocked the door and offered his hand. Hartmann gripped it. His friend's palm was cold with fear. He could feel the tension spreading to him like an infection. He pulled his hand away and stepped out into the corridor. "I'll call you in a few minutes." He said it loudly enough for the party officials to hear. As he approached, they shifted out of the way to let him pass. He strode to the stairs, descended quickly to the lobby, and went out into Wilhelmstrasse. The fresh air braced him. He walked past the brutalist modern facade of the propaganda ministry, waited for a lorry to go by, then crossed the street towards the Chancellery. The forecourt was crowded with 20 or 30 official cars, long black limousines with swastika pennants. Some had SS number plates. It looked as though half the regime had turned up to witness the historic moment when the ultimatum expired. Hartmann showed his identity card to the policeman on the gate and stated his business. He was an official from the Foreign Ministry. He had an urgent message for Herr von Ribbentrop. The mere act of repeating it gave him confidence. It had the merit of being true, after all. The policeman opened the gate. He strode rapidly around the perimeter path of the courtyard to the main entrance. A pair of SS guards blocked his way, then stood aside even before he had finished his explanation. Inside the crowded lobby, he counted 3 more guards with machine guns. The high double doors to the reception rooms were closed. A tall SS adjutant in a white ceremonial jacket stood in front of them. His face was unnaturally hard and angular. He looked like the male model in the cigarette advertisement in Potsdamer Platz, except with blonde hair. Hartmann approached him and saluted.
"Heil Hitler! Heil Hitler!"
"I have an urgent message for Foreign Minister Ribbentrop."
"Very well, give it to me, and I'll make sure he gets it."
"I must deliver it personally."
"That is not possible. Foreign Minister Ribbentrop is with the Führer. No one is to be admitted."
"Those are my orders."
"And those are my orders."
Hartmann used his height and 3 centuries of Junker ancestry. He stepped up close to the adjutant and lowered his voice. "Listen to me very carefully, because this is the most important conversation you will ever have in your life. My mission concerns a personal message from the British Prime Minister to the Führer. You will take me to Herr von Ribbentrop immediately, or I can assure you he will speak to the Reichsführer SS, and you will spend the rest of your career shoveling shit in a cavalry barracks." The adjutant was defiant for a second or two. Then something shifted in his clear blue eyes and broke.
"Very well."
He nodded stiffly. "Follow me." He opened the door onto a crowded salon. A central group of perhaps a dozen men were standing beneath the immense diamante chandelier, with smaller clusters radiating out from this inner core. A lot of uniforms, brown, black, grey, blue, were sprinkled among the civilian suits. There was an incessant